Today we are happy to welcome Morgane Koenig from MIT as our speaker. So Morgane got her PhD from UC Davis, working with Nemanja Kaliper. After that, then she did postdocs at Dartmouth and then MIT, where she is now, a postdoctoral fellow. Her interests span the range of cosmology, from inflation to low redshift like dark matter. And today she'll tell us about some of her work on the topic of the cosmological gravitational wave background. So please take it away, Morgane, whenever you're ready.
All right. Thank you for a lovely introduction, and thank you for inviting me. I wish I could have been there in person. I hope to be there at some point in person, but circumstances made it a bit difficult this time. I think today I want to talk about something that I've been working on for the past couple of years, and mainly this is an idea that I have developed with two grad students, one at Pittsburgh University and one at Brown. It kind of came from the realization that a lot of the dark matter searches were only in one direction. And I know the title doesn't say dark matter yet, but it's going to come in a second. And I think that we have done cosmology in one way for the past, I don't know, 50 years. But lately, we have these beautiful new tools where we can actually detect gravitational waves. And so as a cosmologist, I was asking myself, what kind of information can we get from those gravitational wave detectors, again, on the cosmology side of things? So if one day, hopefully soon enough, we're able to get a very clean signal of a cosmological gravitational wave background, I mean, a stochastic background of cosmological origin, what can we learn from it? So again, as I mentioned, we were able to write two papers with Marcel and Tats. Marcel's at Pittsburgh and Tats is at Brown. And I'm very happy to say that both papers have been accepted by JCAP. So we're really proud of it. And also, I also want to mention that I was the senior person on it. So it was an interesting experience for me, and I'm very proud that we brought this project together. So just a few background slides on gravitational wave detectors. I think everybody knows what it is. So in the past couple of years, we're very lucky to be able to scan the universe with a new tool, mainly gravitational wave detectors. So we have LIGO and Virgo, because I'm European, so I always mention Virgo, which are using this technology, this interferometer technologies, where we have two branches, 4 kilometer long, a game of lasers. And when one of the branch gets stretched or the length is shortened, then there's going to be a phase shift in the two different lasers, and that is going to give us a signal. And so for the first time, we're able to look at the universe, not only using photons as the messengers, but also looking at gravitational waves. And I want to say that thanks to the success of LIGO and Virgo, now the community is on a quest to try to look at a wide range of gravitational waves spanning a really broad frequency. So of course we have the ground-based interferometer LIGO and Virgo, but now we also have this program LISA that is planning on sending an interferometer up in space. And we can also use the PTAs, the pulsar timing arrays, which are a collections of detectors here on Earth that are looking at pulsars. And we can think of pulsars as some sort of astrophysical atomic clock. And so when we see some sort of a shift in the expected signal, that reflects also the presence of a gravitational wave going through space. So of course we have the really exciting announcement of NanoGrav last year, well, a couple of months ago, and for the first time we have really good hopes to I mean, it's the first time that we detected a stochastic gravitational wave background. However, that was mainly of astrophysical sources. That was mainly binary black hole mergers. But we can still hope at some point to get a clean signal of a cosmological stochastic gravitational wave background. So of course, some people may say, okay, it's a long way to go, and this is a little bit, you know, further in the future. I still think it's important to understand, again, the kind of information that would be encapsulated in detecting a cosmological stochastic gravitational wave background. Of course, the analogy is with the CMB, and we can see that there has been a lot of time between the first theoretical prediction of the CMB in 65 by Penzias and Wilson to the first detection in 92 by Kobe. Then again, we had WMAP in the early 2000s, and then finally, the beautiful Planck map that we all know, which finally allowed us to use all this wealth of information. And so even though it took, well, 60 years, I think it's still really important to ask ourselves what we can learn from it. Okay, so stochastic gravitational wave background, what are we looking at? So we're looking at gravitational waves, which are perturbation from the background metric. We usually write those perturbations as the small h. We make the following assumption at this point. We assume that it is stationary, Gaussian, the same in every direction, isotropic, and we assume that there is no polarization. Again, this is just, I think, a simple assumption at this point. Now, the other question is, what are we observing? So we are observing this omega parameter here called the spectral density for the fractional density. Basically, what that measures is a fraction between the energy density of gravitational wave to the total density of the universe, the critical density. And looking at this parameter, we should be able to access the power spectrum of the gravitational waves that we're looking at. So here again, we are working in the TT gauge, which is the one that most people work on, the traceless transverse gauge. We're looking again at this perturbation from the background metric. We're able to get the equation of motion, and then we're able to look at it in Fourier space and access the power spectrum for the gravitational waves. So another interesting thing is whatever we're measuring today is not the same as what has been emitted earlier. And so if we want to have a relation between the this omega parameter that we measure today to the one, to the primordial one, we need to use a transfer function here, this TGW, so that we can actually compare the two different parameters. One thing that I want also to mention is that this this omega is also connected to the number density of graviton. And so this is something that has been really at the core of the rest of this presentation, is that basically what's very important is that we can access the number density of graviton, but most importantly, we can access the change in number density of gravitons. So another thing that, of course, we also have to consider are the different production mechanism. Here, ideally, we would be interested in looking at a stochastic gravitational wave background of cosmological origin. But even when we look at cosmological origin, there's a lot of different sources. The most popular one, obviously, is inflation, but we can also have phase transition, topological defect, and so on and so forth. And even when we look at inflation, depending on the model of inflation that we're looking at, we're going to have different prediction for the power spectrum. Here in this work, we focused on single field inflation. And I know that, again, this is just to take the simplest assumption, because that way we know a lot about what the power spectrum is supposed to be like. But I want to make sure that I understand very well that single field inflationary model are being discarded, that the parameter space is getting smaller. And at some point, we really need to consider multi-field inflation. And there's also a lot of work being done. But for this work, we decided to only look at single field inflation. Of course, we also need to understand the astrophysical contamination. So what are going to be the other astrophysical sources that are going to give us a gravitational wave background? Well, we have the classic one, the binary black holes mergers. We have the binary neutron stars. But I think those sources are also being very well understood. And that way, we can hope one day to, again, have this cosmological background and be able to remove all of the astrophysical contamination, because we understand pretty well what the signal should be. So once again, we had the CMB, we got a lot of information. One day, hopefully, we will have the cosmic gravitational wave background. This map here is actually from white dwarfs, so mergers. So unfortunately, it's not the cosmic gravitational wave background. But again, if we're able to get it one day, what can we do with it? And so what we can do is we can think about what we've learned from the CMB and see if we can do an analog, a gravitational analog to one of the phenomena that gave us a lot of information back in the day. So one of my favorites, I thought it was very beautiful when I learned this, is the SZ effect, the Sunyaev-Zaldovich effect, named after two famous Russian physicists. And here what they realized is that if we look at the photon emitted by the CMB, those photons on their way to the Planck detectors, on their way to us, are going to interact with electrons in the intragalactic medium through Compton scattering. And those electrons are going to give some energy to the CMB photons, changing the number densities of photons. And this change of number densities is going to be translated into a change in intensity. And this intensity curve is going to be slightly shifted, which is going to, again, give us a lot of information about this galactic medium, those electrons in the galactic medium. So I thought it was very interesting. And then, of course, the question that we started trying to ask ourselves is, okay, we have CMBs interacting with electrons. We have CMB photons interacting with electrons. Could we look at gravitons interacting with some particles? And are we able to see a shift? And could we get some information through graviton interacting in a Compton scattering way? Again, if we were to look at graviton scattering of particles, can we also see a change in intensity? So before we were able to do that, we had to really understand where the SZ effect equations were coming from. And so we had to dig up some old papers by Kompanits. And here there's a little anecdote. When I was looking for this paper, it turned out that obviously it's a Soviet physics paper, and it was funded by the Soviet equivalent of, like, basically the H-bomb, the H-bomb Soviet program. And then it was very quickly declassified because they realized that it had basically nothing to do with building an H-bomb. And David Kayser also told me that the reason it was easy to find in English, it was because the CIA was also translating all those documents. Anyway, this is the end of this parenthesis. So the Cold War has something to do with the SZ effect. So here we have to understand, again, the Kompanits equation, which basically look at two types of interaction. So we're looking at a thermal bath of photons and electrons. And here we have to take into account two different processes. The first one is the stimulated emission. It's the idea that when there's a photon of a certain energy that is hitting a hydrogen atom, then this hydrogen is going to emit a photon of the same energy. And so this is going to affect the number of photons, and of course, we also have to take into account the scattering between photons and electron via Compton scattering. And so here in the framework of the SE effect, we had to solve again this Compton equation. We were able to simplify it and to get a very beautiful expression here of the SE effect because we are working in the framework where the optical depth is very low, and also we're working with very low temperature. I mean, this thermal bath is at a very low temperature. So basically here, what we have is this master equation that tells us how the number of photon, of CMB photon changes through stimulated emission and Compton scattering between photons and electrons. And here, again, this is the total master equations, and this W is encapsulated the information about the different cross-section of the Compton scattering. And so here we see that this beautiful equation actually comes with very minimal assumptions, and that we should be able to get something very similar when we look at graviton scattering. So again, here are the assumptions, and we're going to realize that we can make the same assumption for graviton dark matter scattering. So the electron are in thermal equilibrium. We can also assume that gravitons are in thermal equilibrium with beyond the standard model particles. The photons are soft. We can also assume that the gravitons are soft, and the electrons are non-relativistic. Well, we can also assume that dark matter is non-relativistic. So we realize that all this assumption that makes this SE effect coming from the Compton equation easy to solve, or assumption that we can also make in a very different framework. So again, just to summarize, we had the CMB, we want to know what we can know about the cosmic gravitational wave background. We were looking, the SE effect was looking at photon electron scattering. Here, we want to get some information about beyond the standard model particles, maybe dark matter particles. And so here we would be looking at graviton interacting with beyond the standard model particles. We had to solve the Compton equation. Here we have to establish the gravitational equivalent of the Compton equation and solve it. Before we keep going, I just want to make a point. I am not claiming to have discovered graviton, but what I'm saying is that if we work at low energy, we can very well say that the theory of gravity is effectively a theory of a spin two massless particle. And so we can effectively work with graviton at low energy. So here is the first result. We found out that there is a shift in the intensity, but the shift is incredibly small, which is not so surprising because of the Plancken suppression. However, we also looked at scattering between graviton and primordial black holes, primordial black holes making all of the dark matter. And here we actually realized that we had a much bigger effect, and we had a distortion of the order of 0.3% all the way to 5%. So actually, this is pretty encouraging. Okay, so same story here. So we're looking at beyond the standard model particle that are in thermal equilibrium with gravitons. We are assuming that the gravitons are soft, and we're assuming that the beyond the standard model particles that we're looking at are non-relativistic, which again is a good assumption for dark matter particle. Now we're going to look at Compton scattering and stimulated emissions. So I know that before I talked about stimulated emission of photons, we can also look at stimulated emission of graviton. I'm not going to go too much into the details, and maybe we can talk about it a bit more. There's lots of literature about this, and this is something that I'm also trying to understand very much in the nitty gritty, but this is something that is possible. So again, here, looking at those two different processes, we are able to get a shift in to look at the difference of the occupation number of the graviton. And also we have to really look into the different parameters that encapsulate all the processes that we're looking at, mainly encapsulated in those integrals. So here, I mean, I don't think we can talk about it. This is not very interesting. Yeah, sorry. Here, I want to mention something too. Because we're looking again at graviton scattering of dark matter or standard model particles, we're going to have something similar to when we're looking at Coulomb interactions. Mainly, we're going to have to deal with IR divergence. And so we're going to have to find a way to place a cutoff so that we avoid the IR divergence. That's one of the biggest difference between this gravitational wave, this gravitational companies equation and the SZ effect.
So you're making this analogy, you know, so with the KSC, I mean, you know, with the SZ effect, yeah. You know, so like, you know, so for the scattering of you know, of these gravitons, you know, so, you know, like, is the analogy you're making between lensing and Thompson scattering? Like, is that what you're doing?
I'm not, I mean, first of all, Thompson and Compton are basically different sides of the same process, right?
But yeah, exactly. Right. Yeah. You know, so is the analog of the Compton scattering just, you know, normal gravitational lensing? And so KSZ would just be like moving lens.
So we're not looking at KZ. So we're not looking at the kinetic SZ effect. We're just looking at the SZ effect. So everything is non-relativistic here. Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. We're not looking at the KZ effect at this point, because then we have to look at relativistic corrections. And this is not something that we're interested in. Here we really look. Yeah.
Like, but even if it's non-relativistic, there is a KZ effect just from the overall bulk motion. And so similarly, there's like an overall bulk motion of your lens, I guess, which will make like a moving lens effect. Like
a moving lens effect.
Okay. Like,
no, yeah.
I mean, that isn't what you're thinking about. It sounds like, okay.
This is not something, but maybe we should talk about it after. Maybe. Okay. Yeah.
May I also ask a question here? Like, it's somewhat related. Like, what is the analog of the fine structure constant here?
The analog of the, why is it, because I mentioned the Coulomb scattering, or
in for photons, right? Like right. It's like the fine structure constant that determines like the scattering expanse and stuff, right? Like that, right? So what is the analog of that here?
I have to think about it.
Is it like bigger than one or smaller than one in for your case?
No, it's pretty small. It's very small.
I guess the question is really, what is the cross section? Because I mean, the finite structure constant just enters the Thompson cross section. If I understand the question, so here's what is the cross section here?
I'm gonna get to it.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was actually like this was one of the thing that took us the longest to be able to get a decent cross section that we could work with. Because here we actually need the differential cross section. And I'm not going to go into details, but we had to involve spinor helicity to try to get something somewhat clean. But I'm still going to think about what would be the actual analog of the fine structure constant, like the actual number, because that's a good question. As I mentioned, again, what we're looking at is we're looking at GR as an effective field theory, because we're staying at pretty low energies. If we stay at low energies, we can say that GR is just a unique theory of a massless spin two particle. So again, I'm not claiming to have discovered graviton. I'm just saying that at the limit that we're working at, we can consider gravity as basically graviton interacting. Here are the different interaction that we're interested in. And as you can see, I mentioned that we had a little problem with the IR divergence. And here you can see it with the last diagram, which is our T diagram. And you can see that we have a graviton self-interaction that's going to be a little bit problematic. This is where the fun part of the issues are coming from. So before I show you the the cross sections. I just want to mention this because, again, if we have a divergence, we cannot keep working. So we have to find a way to deal with this, to regularize it somehow. And what we're going to do is we're going to involve the fact that we are only working in the geometric optics limit. So here we're only interested in this limit. So which means that we can have a lower bound, I mean, a high bound on our wavelengths and a lower bound on the theta, I mean, the scattering angle, the angle of scattering. So here, if we follow the prescription from the geometric optics limit, what we have to do is we can look at again at the equation of motion for the graviton, and we can look at a upper bound or lower bound. Mainly a lower bound on the wavelength that allows us to talk about gravity or GR as a wave. So to do this, we have to look at what's called the Kretschmann scalar, again, that puts a upper bound on our, a lower bound on our wavelengths and upper bound on one of the wavelengths. Now, when we look at our object, at first thought, we thought, okay, we can describe it as a Schwarzschild metric, and then we can evaluate the Kretschmann scalar for that metric. And this should basically tell us that we can consider wave-like effect in a certain regime, which would be between the Schwarzschild radius of our object and this R lambda radius, which is basically decided by this geometric optics limit. So this is a prescription that's being used a lot when looking at graviton scattering of astrophysical objects. However, we thought about it and then we realized that we're looking at graviton scattering of particles. And so a wavelength or length scale mainly that would be more appropriate here instead of taking the Schwarzschild radius of our object would be to simply take the Compton wavelengths of our objects. It's a lot more relevant here. And so here, basically, what we're saying is we have wave-like effect in the region between the Compton wavelengths and this R lambda that is defined by this geometric optics limit. And so that way we're able to put a cutoff on our scattering angle so that we could deal with the IR divergences. So I think this is something that's actually pretty classic. Maybe there's a better way to do it, and I will be happy to hear if there are other suggestions. So again, this way we were, because again, if you remember in this Companions equation, those integrals encapsulate all of the mechanism that we have, mainly this Compton scattering, and also encapsulate the graviton stimulated emission. And that way we were able to make sure that everything worked out using the geometric optics approximation. And basically you can think about this upper bound as an impact parameter, this region, this upper bound on the region where the wave-like effects are relevant. Okay, then we also had to evaluate the differential cross-sections for the graviton scattering off beyond the standard model particles, or I mean, you can also call it dark matter particle, right? And so,
I got confused by this infrared cutoff. So you say wave-like effect, they're important at small impact parameter or at large impact parameter? Because I would guess they're important at small impact parameter, right? When the wave enters into the region of large curvature. So at small impact parameter, I have large scattering angles. So that gives me a kind of cutoff on the big, on the upper cutoff on the angle. But you are using somehow to put a lower cutoff. Can you repeat it? How do you do it?
Because large impact parameter means small angle, right?
Yeah. But how do you infer it from applicability of like geometric versus wave optics? At larger impact parameter, geometric optics should work, I would guess. The curvature is small, right? The curvature radius. the curvature radius is large. Yeah, the curvature is small. Right. The curvature radius is large. So the wavelength is much smaller than the curvature radius at large impact parameters. And there is no kind of geometric optics is applicable all the way to infinity, I would guess.
Right.
Right. So how do you put the upper bound on the impact parameter from what arguments?
Okay, I'm trying to understand the question. So yeah, okay, I see what you mean. So I mean, actually, I'm not sure I completely understand. So if we have a large scattering angle, then there's no problem. If we have a small scattering angle, then we have some issues.
Why is that? Yeah, I think I'm not understanding. I'm not understanding this connection. Yeah.
Why a small scattering angle? Because if we go all the way to zero, I mean, we are going to have, if we go, I'm not sure I'm answering this right, but if we go all the way to zero and if we have no lower bound, then basically it's the same thing that we have when we look at the Coulomb interactions, and we're going to have basically contribution coming from infinity. So we have to put a lower bound.
But how do you connect it to geometric versus wave optics? Yeah, that's what I'm missing. I mean, when you consider like Coulomb, like Compton scattering, or like Coulomb scattering, we put a cutoff, you know, from for example, from device screening. Yeah, I mean, if I consider something like plasma, right? So then we have screening of the force at large distances, and that's how we cut it off. So we don't appeal to wave optics. So yeah, so that's that's confusing me. How do you make the argument from the wave optics?
But I think, again, I think here this is the same thing. Geometric optics or wave-like phenomena, that's the same thing. This is where the confusion is.
But then I would say at large impact parameter, the geometric optics should work well. I can treat my wave packet as small compared to the impact parameter. So I just have just geometric optics.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, okay, maybe go on. Yeah, maybe I will ask you at the end again. Yeah.
Right, I think we should go. Yeah, I think I have to think about it, but yeah, I'll think about it. Anyway, okay, so where was I? Yeah, okay, so here we were able to evaluate the differential cross-section for our interaction between graviton and those beyond the standard model particles. And again, then what we had to do is evaluate those integrals so that we could establish the gravitational components equation. So one way to understand those parameters is they all depend on here, the delta that is at the end here, which is the difference of energy of our graviton. So it's the difference between the energy of the outgoing graviton to the incoming graviton. And so depending on the order of this parameter, then we have different orders for those integrals. So we can understand the lower one as being the average energy transferred, and the higher second order one as being the energy squared transfer. And of course, we can keep on adding extra terms. But in the limit that we're looking at, the first two are good enough to tell us basically what's happening. One other thing. So here, I think I mentioned that already. We also have to make some assumptions about the gravitational wave background that we're looking at, mainly what sources we're looking at. And we are still looking at single field inflation, which again is the simplest assumption, because then we know that the power spectrum has to go as x to the minus two, and so that way we're able to see what the shift in occupation number of the graviton should be. Okay, and so now we were able to establish again the change in these omega parameters, which can be translated in a change in occupation number of the graviton, which again can also be translated in a change in intensity. So here, what we can see is two things. On the first, on the graph on the right, we can see that there is indeed a shift in the change of occupation numbers or omega. So here we plotted the absolute value because depending on the frequency that we're looking at, the gravitons are either going to gain energy, so this is the right side of the plot, or going to lose energy, which is on the left side of the plot, which would have been, which is negative, normally speaking. We can also see that, and it is unsurprising that it is spin dependent, which makes sense because this is really just a collisions. And so the higher the spin, the more energy is going to be transfer during the scattering process. And then on the left, this is also important. We had to look at the optical depth, which basically give us information about the amount of scattering that we're going to have with respect to the redshift. And here we can see that most of the scatterings are going to happen at very high redshift, mainly in the radiation era. So that also gives us an idea of where we have to look at and the range of redshift that we have to integrate in. And so, yeah.
Question: what is spin? Are you talking about a spin of the BSM particle that's scattering? Okay.
Yes.
And the BSM particle was just a primordial black hole.
Not now. Now it's just the beyond the center model particle.
I see. And then, what is the nature of the interaction between the BSM particle and graviton here?
Oh, basically we're looking at, again, interaction between graviton and scalar field or spin one or spin half field. I didn't put all of the differential cross sections, but this is something that we can talk about again later. Those are the classic, also with non-minimal coupling, graviton interacting with the scalar field. Yeah. Or a spin half, or
is it minimal coupling or non-minimal coupling? It is.
Oh, it's minimal coupling. Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Minimal coupling. Yeah, non-minimal coupling is something that we have to do. That is always in my mind. But no, it's unfortunately minimal coupling. Yeah. Okay. So here again, I just want to mention and emphasize that this was something that we really wanted to do mainly to establish a formalism. We were not really expecting to see a signal that would be very strong. I mean, here there is a distortion, but the distortion is incredibly small. So this is not something that we can expect to see. So basically, we're not going to be able to constrain dark matter as a particle looking at the shift in the cosmological gravitational wave background. However, then we also thought about looking at primordial black holes as dark matter candidates. And we're mainly interested in the part of the parameter space that is not constrained, mainly where primordial black holes are roughly of asteroid-like masses. And here again, they can make up to all of the dark matter. And so we looked at it to see again if we could see a shift and if potentially this method could constrain this parameter space. So here there are two differences in the approach. The first one is so I was talking about well, maybe I should have more of a conversation with Professor Siburiakov about it, but I was talking about the cutoff that we had to implement. And when we're looking at particles, we can expect, again, wave-like effect between the Compton wavelength distance and this optic geometric distance. But here we're looking at a bigger object. So here, instead of looking at the Compton wavelengths, we're looking at the Schwarzschild radius, and so we're going to have a little bit of a different different mass dependencies. Another important difference is that when we were looking at beyond the standard model particles, we assumed that they all were identical and that they all had the same mass. Here, this is something also that we wondered. Can we assume that primordial black holes have the same mass? Because we know naively that black holes do not have all the same mass. But then by looking at the literature, it's really easy to see that it's not so much of a stretch to assume that we have a delta distribution here. If you look at the literature, you can realize that it's very picked around one particular region, with again some discussions about the tail, but this is not something that we really worried about here. And then I think maybe the last thing that we had to look into is what temperature are we going to take into account? And once that, again, we decided to take a monochromatic mass distribution, it was pretty natural to think about taking the Hawking temperature for those primordial black holes. Because as opposed to the case of beyond the standard model particle, where we had a thermal bath between our graviton and our particles here, we cannot consider primordial black holes as we're not in the thermal case anymore. So here we took the Hawking temperature as the temperature of our object. So again, looking at asteroid-like objects, so roughly 10 to the minus 16 solar masses, that corresponds to a temperature of the order of keV. And so then we did the exact same analysis with, again, those little differences, right, which were actually quite important. What we saw was that when we're looking at gravitational wave interacting with one primordial black hole, so again, just looking at really the one-to-one scattering, this gave us a distortion of 0.5%, right? Not 0.5%. So of course it's still pretty small, but it's way bigger than what we had with our particle like dark matter. And then we also looked at what happens when we, instead of thinking about primordial black holes as like a single object and a gravitational wave hitting this single object, what if we think about it more as clustered together? And that way we can think about a gravitational wave hitting a more of a cluster of primordial black holes. And this would definitely give some sort of enhancement, because at that point, although the density does not change, the mass will change. And we would have an enhancement basically of, I think, 70, a factor of 70. So here we would have a spectral distortion that would go from 0.3% to up to 5%. So this is actually something quite significant and potentially could put bounds on asteroid mass-like primordial black holes. So again,
about temperature. So you say you take Hawking temperature. Why it's relevant? Because I'm trying just again to make the analogy with the standard SZ. So there we have thermal electrons, and basically, this SZ is due to Doppler shift, right, of the photons that scatter on electrons. So temperature enters with the velocity of the electrons, the variance of the velocity. So for these asteroid mass black holes, like Hawking temperature, would it set the variance of the velocity? Or how actually does it enter at all in the scattering? Because you still consider scattering, right, of an incoming graviton on a black hole, right?
Yeah.
So if I want to use the analogy with the usual SZ, I have to put the velocity the spread of the velocities
exactly
of the black holes in there.
Exactly. But here here we cannot take into account the velocity. So instead of this, we have to look at the. So it's basically when we're looking at the mass and momentum distribution of our object. And as you said, the spread. So for electrons, we're able to look at the velocity here. We had to look at a different type of phenomena. So instead of looking at the velocity, we're basically looking at the temperature. if that makes sense.
Temperature, yeah, but why Hawking temperature is relevant? That's what I'm a bit confused. How does it enter? How does it enter actually in your in cross section or in this Companion's equation, for example?
In the cross section, it's not going to play a role. It's going to play a role when we're looking at the we have to make assumption about the distribution. So we always assume that the distribution is Maxwell-Boltzmann, for example, and this is going to play into account in the Companion's equation in the way that we're looking basically at the occupation number of, I don't know if I have it here, but so here, if you look at the N equivalent, we need to know about the momentum distribution of our beyond the center model particles. And so mm-hmm. here, we always assume the Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution. So we basically also looked at the spread of the velocity. So now with primordial black holes, we're not able to do it. So we have to find another way to try to understand the distribution.
Right. Yeah, yeah. Very good. Very good. So okay. So you have Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution for primordial black holes. That's where you put Hawking temperature. So basically, you say that Hawking temperature sets the proper velocity, like intrinsic velocities of black holes as well. Is it
exactly? Yep.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. Mm-hmm. That's good. I think I almost said everything that I wanted to say. So again, here we actually with this enhancement mechanism, we actually are able to get a pretty significant distortion. But again, I want to make sure that this also comes, we still have to take into account the fact that we assume single field inflation model for our cosmological gravitational wave background. So I think that looking at gravitational equivalent to a mechanism that we know or mechanism that we looked at with the CMB, in my opinion, is also a very good way to look at it because now we can really get more information with those gravitational wave background. Now, of course, there's still an enormous amount of work that needs to be done. Mainly, we need to understand very well what kind of background are given by different cosmological sources. I think the astrophysical contaminations is pretty well understood, or it's getting incredibly well understood. So again, as I mentioned, we can look at different sources. We can try to understand what kind of power spectrum they would give us. We can maybe think about this cutoff issue in a better way. This is something that, as mentioned, this is something that at some point maybe we can do and we really have to address. We can also look at dark matter composites, because here again we realized that when we kind of put all those black holes together, we really had an enhancement from 0.3% to 5%. So it's actually quite significant. But we did not look at anything like this for dark matter particles. And I know there is a lot of models out there. There's those globals. There is those axion quark composites dark matter. That would also give us an enhancement, because then we would actually, instead of having just a single graviton interacting off a single dark matter particle, then we would have a graviton interacting with multiple particles, and this could also enhance the signal. Although for dark matter particle, the signal needs to be enhanced like enormously. So I don't think that this is very promising. But again, I still think that for primordial black hole, that was a very we're very, very happy to get this result. Another extension, as I mentioned, is to look at non-minimal coupling to see if, again, that would also give us an enhancement. But again, we need such a big enhancement that I don't really know if this would give us something else. And then something else that I've been thinking about is Here, we only assume that when we looked at primordial black holes, we assumed that it was making all of the dark matter because we're looking at this particular parameter space. But I mean, it's probably unlikely that they make all of the dark matter. So now what we can also look into is scenarios where we have primordial black holes, but also other type of dark matter. And what would happen is that we would have actually a cloud of dark matter around this primordial black hole. And we could think about scenarios where we would have primordial black hole mergers, and this cloud of dark matter would actually have an effect on the rate of that merger. That would be very interesting to see if we can also connected to the spin, and if the signature that we can get from such a mechanism could give us some information about the spin of the dark matter if we think about dark matter again as an elementary particle. So I think I'm almost out of time, but thank you.
Okay, great. Thanks very much, Morgan. So let's all give Morgan a round of applause for her very interesting talk. Okay, great. So are there any further questions for the speaker?
Can I have a question regarding the phase transition? How does it influence gravitational wave, the phase transition that you mentioned? And do you think we can have something similar to critical opalescence for the gravitational wave?
Sorry, I didn't hear the last part of the question.
The critical opalescence. An analog of critical opalescence for the gravitational wave.
I'm unfortunately not familiar with the mechanism of critical opalescence. Can you tell me more about it? I don't know what it is actually.
For instance, when we have a gas in the, I think at the point of a phase transition of first order, it would become kind of opaque regarding light. So the gas after at the point of a phase transition,
right,
instead of being transparent, it would become kind of a milky gas.
Okay.
But this is about a scattering of light and gas.
Yeah.
Now I was wondering whether we have similar thing for gravitational wave in a way Okay.
Right. I mean, I think this is a very good question, and this is very interesting. I think it should be possible. I think that a lot of this is the thing that's so interesting about graviton is that a lot of the effects that you have with photons are actually applicable with graviton. Now, again, the only issue is that you have to make sure that it is in the right regime. Because if it's at, but this sounds actually like it's pretty much of a low energy phenomenon. So I think this should work. Because the only problem is if you go when you go at high energy, then you cannot really think about it as graviton scattering anymore. But if you stay at low, actually this is very interesting. I think definitely going to look into it. Yeah, I mean,
it would be correct. We would have such kind of phenomena. It causes a gap in the gravitational wave spectrum.
I mean, it would create a gap, right? Because,
Because then, it is wake toward a very special spectrum of photons.
Right.
It is not, it is transparent for the rest of the photons.
Right. Yeah. So then you would be able to see, But then the question is, when does it happen? In what scenario does it happen? I think this is a very, very interesting question because then you should definitely be able to see a feature in the gravitational wave detection. Very interesting.
Thank you.
Yeah.
So James has a question. Go ahead, James. James, are you still there?
You're muted, James.
Maybe there's some audio problem. Well, okay, yeah, he'll have to type. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, well, while he's typing, are there other questions?
I can ask something. So this question of minimum angle, at some level, I'm not sure how relevant it is because you don't care about you need the kick in the momentum because basically that's the Campanius equation is it's some moment of the momentum kick, the first and second moments. And so these very low angle scatterings have very small momentum, change in momentum. So I think that, I mean, this infrared divergence shouldn't be important for them. I'm not sure whether, you've thought about that. I mean, is there actually an infrared divergence when you calculate this J1 and J2, or is there not?
At least we did. I mean, in the beginning, we didn't put a cutoff and we did have a divergence.
You have a divergence. Okay.
But again, maybe we have to look into it. I mean, maybe there's something that we didn't consider. It's very possible. But when we did it, just naively, we did have a divergence.
Uh-huh. Okay. It looks like James managed to type. Yeah, go ahead. I think, yes, you can read this question.
All right. So can you read it or should I read it for you, Morgan?
Can you read it? Because if I don't know.
Okay, no worries. So James is noting, so we can treat Thompson scattering classically by thinking of an EM wave causing an electron to oscillate. And so is there some analogy for your case like this?
Again, the Thompson and the Compton scattering are the same. They're basically the two different limits, right?
No. So he's talking now about, you know, some analog for your scattering of gravitational waves. Is there some like classical analog?
Classical analog. Sorry, again, I'm not sure I understand the question. Classical analog to the Compton scattering?
Right. Okay. He wrote some more. So rather than absorbing gravitons, can you understand this, just about absorption of gravitational waves, he's saying.
Okay. Rather than absorbing graviton, I see. Can you think about absorption? Absorption of gravitational waves. That's a good question.
Mm-hmm.
I think so. I mean, I don't see what would prevent it. And that would be obviously super interesting because then when you look at the signal, what you would have would be a dip. And I think this is possible. I think this is another thing that's interesting. Another thing that's super interesting is those, this is maybe off topic, but those mixing, the mixing sometimes. I mean, I was looking at photon, axion, graviton mixing, and then because of those mixing, you can have you can expect also a dip in the gravitational spectrum because you're going to have less graviton of a certain nature. So yeah, I think this is also, yeah. Oh, yeah. Yep.
Yeah, maybe I'm still as puzzled about some. Okay, I mean, like, right, like, so you emphasize that all of this is for like minimal coupling. And so you're finding this spectral distortion in the gravitational wave spectrum. So then, similarly, would you expect to find similar spectral distortions in photons?
In photons, meaning what, graviton-photon interaction or photons?
Yeah, so it sounds like you're saying that there's spectral distortions arising from gravitational interactions.
Right.
And so then, would I expect to see spectral distortions arising from gravitational lensing?
Yeah, I mean, I think so. I mean, again, I think the question is, I think there's a lot of different possibilities. Now, the issue is that a lot of the interactions are so small that the question is it really worth pursuing, right? But I think But I think it would be the same thing. I think you would also be able to see it with gravitational lensing. You would have to look at graviton and photon. But I think that would be... That would be too small to really give us anything interesting.
Whereas for gravitational waves, you're saying the effect is much larger. It's like several percent you were finding.
Right.
Mm.
Right.
Okay, interesting. Okay, let's see if there's no further questions. Last chance. Okay, all right. So let's stop here then.